strength of it, I got married. I'm going to the young woman from Cornell, who was actually had been Dennis's private secretary, and she had typed my thesis at home to see how these things get started. I went to her and said, look here, we can go to Germany and live there for a year, be a great experience, come back and find something. Surely the depression will be over by then. And so I had my passport, and then just 5 weeks before I was to sail, I got a telegram saying a whole Austauschdienst program has collapsed. Hitler refuses to let any young man, especially one with a technical training, leave Germany under any conditions. Therefore, they can't send anybody over. We can't send any Americans there. So there I was. I had a passport. I had a steamship ticket. And I had no fellowship. Well, I said to the young lady, who unfortunately has died, I said, see here, I've saved up a sum of money, an amount or two, $280 or something. It'll be enough to get us across to Germany. Maybe I can borrow enough to get us through for at least a tour of Europe and come back. We can travel third class on the... That's not tourist, it's almost steerage on some of the lines. Well, Priscilla contributed some money of her own. Two of us went to Europe, stayed there for a month and a half, toured all over Germany, France, a piece of Italy, and into England to visit Sidgwick and others at Oxford, whom I knew, and came back all on $300. Now, when you speak of depression and well, speak of inflation and so on, yeah, just take a look. People complain about the increase in postal rate, but my goodness, look at the minimum wage. Jimlin Gain, I want to write a minute on life of Jimlin Gain. He got a job out of school, I guess is what, before he went to graduate school. Anyway, he calculated out, it came to 34 cents an hour. Now the minimum wage is $3.50 or $3.85.
Oh, it might even be higher, but it's, yes.
Well, I want to make it higher. Maybe it is higher by now, four and a half, something. But anyway, it's over 100 times what then. People said, inflation, we got that under control. Malarkey. Well, all right. I got the job at GE thanks to Pat Node, and I went in there. And
How did Pat Node know about you?
Well, he was at Cornell. He got his degree with L.M. Dennis.
Okay, so...
And I got...
It's all part of the Dennis fraternity, as it were.
Yes, yes, that's okay. It. The matter of academic father and grandfather and so on and so on.
So when the fellowship fell through in Germany, you had already told Pat Node you were going to go to Germany.
Yes.
Is that right? So did you come back and say to him, I'm not going? Do you still have something?
Happened 5 weeks before I was to sail, and I immediately rushed to Pat Node and said, and this has happened, is the Hot Point job still open? Well, yes, he said, we haven't found anybody else. I knew you could, I think you could do it, but wham, I got the job there. Yes, it was not 3,000, it was 2,700. no, not 200, not 300, $270 a month. And so I've moved to Schenectady and learned about GE Research Lab and arc furnace and fusing magnesium oxide. It's a great thing to run an arc furnace. We had an experimental one, and Navius had set up in the laboratory because he wanted to make fused beryllium oxide, fused aluminum, and so on for his insulation studies. Well, to have a big steel cylinder and fill it full of magnesium oxide that is calcined magnesite, and make a hole. Well, first you have two graphite electrodes so big, come down like this. Put those in first, then fill it all in with the magnesia. First at the bottom, put a short piece of graphite rod between the electrodes. Fill it all in with magnesium oxide, and then turn on the current and burn through the short rod there and start an electric arc. And then keep piling in magnesia and keep it going with, I don't know, maybe 60 kVA. Gee, it gets awful hot in there. Magnesium oxide periclase melts at 2800 degrees. 2805, that's way above the melting point of quartz or of corundum. Thing like that, but very interesting. You build up, raise the electrodes, or they gradually burn away. You build up an irregular ingot, building up a puddle of fused magnesium oxide, and just then shut off the current and let it all cool in there. It'll take maybe 2 days to cool, but finally, you dig it out and you have this cylinder and whack it with a sledgehammer, break it up. Inside are crystals of magnesium oxide. If it's real pure, you get magnificent crystals so long. So I said, aha, now I'll settle this thing. What's the electrical conductivity of magnesium oxide at 900 or 1,000 degrees C? Nobody knew. All right, yeah. I got some crystals of quartz that size, and I'm going to tell you the trouble I had. Well, I got some pure magnesium metal and hydrated it in an autoclave with steam, converted to the hydroxide, converted that to oxide, fused the pure oxide, and made crystals of pure magnesium oxide so long. I had crystals corundum too, so it's in here. Electrical conductivity of quartz periclase and corundum at temperatures up to 1,000 degrees. Oh boy, periclase is the one. There's no doubt about it. There's nothing remotely like it. So I did that as a side issue. I was just for the scientific value, and I told the hot point people, "Look, you've got to have the fundamental facts." They said, "We can't use anything but periclase anyway." Well, I know that, but they said, "What's effective impurities? Can you get pure magnesium oxide?" And I said, "I'll find out. I'll add 1/2, 1/10%, 1%, 2% of silica, of aluminum, of calcium oxide, anything you want. We'll have to do this successively, and we fuse it, go through the whole rigmarole, bake up, polarize the periclase with the impurities in it, and make experimental CalRod units and test them. Electrical conductivity, life, and so on is very illuminating, because some of the things, well, lime, they thought that wouldn't be bad at all. Oh, but lime combines with the oxide of the Inconel sheath, and pretty soon the sheath fails. And of course you can't have any alkalis there because of the conductivity. And alumina was not good, but silica wasn't bad. Interesting thing I found out was that if you had a certain amount of lime, because you're using a natural product, magnesite, you could then add silica to it to counteract the alkalinity of the lime, and so make a perfectly useful thing. Oh, at that point, people thought this was great. So they said, hey, you're coming along so well on this. Suppose we continue the fellowship there. You stay with it? Sure, I'll stay with it. Would I stay with it? So it went on, extended for a year. And then it went on from there, and all sorts of things happened.
So you went there in 35. Okay. And were you reporting to Patnode at this, during this time, or were you reporting to someone else? Or you were you dealing with Hot Point directly?
No, I reported to Louis Navias, the microscopist, the mineralogist. He came there from the, not the U.S. Geological Survey, but from a federal agency that had to do with imports and so on. They had him analyze ores and things that came in, and he was an expert microscopist, and he was astonished to find that I knew one end from another of a microscope. I had taken not Chameau, but fellow followed him, see the I had taken the course, we all had to take course in elementary chemical microscopy at Cornell, so I knew how to identify isotropic from anisotropic things, and this index of refraction and extinction angles and all of that. And Navias was amazed at this. He never found anybody in graduate school who knew this. So I was kept on as assistant to Navias for quite a while. So you're going to ask how I got into silicones? Or?
Well, I know that in 1938 there was a visit to Corning.
Nothing.
But you weren't included.
Not on my part, no.
Okay.
See, I worked on the sixth floor with Navias. All the chemists, including the hotshot guys in physical chemistry, like Marshall, on the fifth floor, and we didn't mix much with them. I was busy, had my own work, and they had theirs. I knew they were working on all sorts of polymers, including, well, the chief thing was wire enamels. They wanted something that could coat on a piece of wire and keep the wires apart during the winding and everything else, without having to wind cotton fibers on the wire first. That took up space and bulk and had air in it, or didn't have the dielectric strength. So they got very far with this. The poly. Polyvinyl. Not glycerol, but two carbon atoms with two OH groups on. You esterify this with, well, you condense it with a polyhydric alcohol and make a polymer. Anyway, the trade name was N-Gliptal, but they made wire enamels that really did the job. Gee, it looked like bare copper wire, and they could put it all through the winding machine, intricate shapes, and then ram it in the spaces in the between the laminated core, the punched out spaces, and not short-circuit the thing. This was amazing. Well, they had their place. I was with Navius, and Navius was my mentor, and I was getting along working as his assistant. And another thing came up, too, which surprised him and William David Coolidge, and that was somebody by the name of Otto Hahn, who had been Baker lecturer at Cornell, very genial, nice, such a nice fellow, mixed with all the students, and everybody got along with Otto Hahn.
That was during the time you were a student there?
Yes.
Hahn was there.
And it came out that Hahn had working with him a young colleague and assistant named Meitner, Lisa Meitner, and she had discovered something that when they're trying to extend the periodic table, you bombard heavy metals, and they chose uranium along with uranium, and they chose uranium, they chose thorium and all sorts of things. Bombard them with neutrons and make heavy isotopes which would decay to new elements. And Hahn had done this with uranium, and go through a chemical separation and follow the things by the radioactivity. Now the energy of the rays that come off and all that. And they discovered something very strange. They had to put in a carrier to take along the radioactive substance, because it wasn't enough to precipitate by itself. You adsorbed it on a carrier, it was chemically similar. They found the stuff was going with the bromine fraction, and there was no explanation for that. There was no heavy analog of bromine that would do this. Nevertheless, it was there. It appeared as though the uranium atom split into two unequal halves. And Hahn couldn't believe it. Meitner was certain of her results. She did over and over and over. Finally, Hahn wrote a paper about it to send in as a letter to the editor. And then he told me later, he put it in the mailbox and immediately wished he had it back. He said, "I'll be a laughing stock of..." And in that paper, he said he had no explanation for this. It appeared as though a bromine-like isotope or element was being formed and gave the radioactive properties of it, but... Well, Lisa Meitner's nephew, remember his name, he said, "Why, the uranium atom must be splitting." Yes, and it
wasn't Strassmann, was it? Strassmann?
It doesn't sound right.
Okay.
Maybe it'll come to me later on. Anyway, this became known, and of course, then it was taken up by others who said, "Well, this should be a tremendous source of energy." You mention energy, the General Electric Company, and you get a reaction. They immediately wanted to know whether this is a possible commercial source of energy to use in their heat engine generating system, the central station. That's their big business, central station equipment, the huge turbines that they made, the huge generators and all the switching equipment, all that still do. So, yeah, they wanted somebody who knew something about fluorine to make some uranium hexafluoride. Well, they wanted a volatile compound of uranium. Well, gee, any inorganic chemists tell you right away, uranium hexafluoride is it. sulfur hexafluoride, carbon tetrafluoride, all these things that to a fluorine chemist these are so clear. Could you make us some marine hexafluoride? Well, I could, but I'd have to start by building a fluorine cell and making the fluorine. Well, go ahead and do it. Take time. We'll supply the money. So I built a fluorine cell and got some uranium and built the vacuum system and made uranium hexafluoride and turned it over to Kingsley, head of the physicist group, do this. It was all sealed up in a nice glass ampoule, drew it off with a torch, said, look, these beautiful, very refractive, highly refringent crystals of uranium hexafluoride, the vapor above it, of course, and they took this, they opened that up to the air, spoiled the whole thing. Well, do it all over again, so on. So I was fluorine chemist. So, yeah, I was with Navi. So I did not go on that visit to Corning. I didn't know a damn thing about the visit to Corning. But Patnode came back, and I was having dinner with him over at his house one night, and he said that Corning has made ethyl phenyl silicone. They explained about Kipping's work and so on. They've all told them all very readily. Corning Glassworks vice president had gone to General Electric with the story first and then had invited them to go see this. He wanted to sell glass fibers and foresaw a big business there. He wanted it used in electrical insulation and machinery. You can't use it there unless you have some binder, something to fill up the interstices and give dielectric strength and so on. So, of course, they had brought in James Franklin Hyde from Harvard, and he came up. He was an organic chemist. He knew about Kipping's work. I think he even had a copy of that famous textbook. Perkin and Kipping.
Perkin and Kipping.
Mm-hmm. Perkin. Perkin and Kipping. So, all right, he had made phenyl silicone, the easiest one, and of course it's resinous and it splits and so on, it melts easily. He made ethyl silicone, but that, well, turned out to put one phenyl group and one ethyl group on silicon, make the dichloride, hydrolyze this, make a siloxane chain, ethyl and phenyl groups, and Hyde made his so-called varnish from this. And that was what was explained to GE people on the visit to Schenectady. And so Marshall and Patnode went to Corning, and Hyde showed them his samples, what he'd done and how he made it and so on, and urged GE to take up this work because Corning wanted to sell the glass fibers and they had other things to do and so on. But
it's my understanding that and I think this is based on something Earl Warwick said in his book, that Corning initially was hoping to for a joint venture with GE. The stories, it doesn't always come together, and that's one thing I've heard, and I don't know whether that's true or not, but that they were looking at a joint venture working together.
Well, as William David Coolidge said to me, look, Corning Glassworks is virtually a branch, a department of General Electric. They work so closely developing the machinery for the automatic manufacture of lamps. That was GE's business at the beginning. to make the lamps as well as the equipment of Edison and the arc light man transformers at Pittsfield. The three of them combined to form the General Electric Company. Lighting was their thing, and so the GE Lamps works at Cleveland, worked with Corning people all the time, and so Coolidge encouraged Marshall to go out in some aspect of this, because he said, we get along so well with Corning, everything we've done, share patents and so on.